an original.
From Story Studio Network.
Well, hello, here we go. Sixth day of February, 2023. Welcome in, Dave Trafford here. It's Now and Next for Story Studio Network. We are in your feed Monday to Thursday with this program. News of the day, and we dig in on one of the bigger stories of the week. Today, we're going to feature a conversation with our friend Lisa Taylor from Challenge Factory, because all the buzz over the last couple of weeks, for whatever reason, it seems to be about the resources that we are ignoring in the workplace, shall we say. And for the most part, that is attached to a specific demographic, specific age cohort. And the fact is, it's going to be something we need to deal with, because more and more of us, and certainly our kids, are more likely to live to 100 years old. What's that going to mean in terms of the services that we need, we provide, we pay for, and the workplace? So that's on the way here on Now and Next, and we'll get into that discussion presently. Just by the way, I'm going to let you know, if you want to connect with us, you can do so on social media. At Dave Trafford finds me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So happy to connect with you there. All right, first story out of the gate. A screaming headline this morning in the National Post. Most Canadians agree Canada is broken, and they're angry about it, based on a poll done by the folks at Léger. Here's the question. Recently, a Canadian politician stated that, quote, "it feels like everything is broken in this country right now," end quote. To what extent do you agree or disagree with that statement? 67% net agree, strongly agree 30%, somewhat agree 38%. So the disagrees were around 25%. It's a real flashy headline. I have no doubt it's going to catch a lot of clicks online. Breaks it all down in terms of where we're most angry. Women, it seems, are more angry than men. Albertans are more angry than anybody else in the country. But everywhere in the country, according to this story, we're all angry, the majority of us. Now, here's the problem with the story. It doesn't, as far as I can see, show me the work, so to speak. I don't see the tables. I don't see the actual numbers as they're broken down. Having said all of that, they do provide some of the questions, and they are looking at the way this is playing out. And as you read through it, of course, they're referencing Pierre Poilievre, who is the one who initially said, you know, Canada's broken. Now it's become this political fight back and forth. When he says, you know, Canada is broken, he's talking politically. He's blaming the governments of the day. Here's the danger in that. This applies, based on this story and this interpretation of the poll, right across all levels of government. Most of the provinces are led by conservatives. So Mr. Poilievre may be able to say, you know, it's all broken and it's a problem with the Liberal government. That could be true. And that's how most of us would appear, based on these numbers, perceive that. The problem is, this isn't about political stripe necessarily. It's indicative of our feeling around the way the country is running. And the number one issue that they put out in front of people, they gave a list, which one of these things is the most likely to be, you know, make you angry, make you feel like it's broken. And inflation is the number one issue. Healthcare is too. And so those two things are right across the country. Those two things are not particular to one party. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Having said all of that, we're polling on feelings. Do you feel like the country is broken? As opposed to saying, do you feel like our healthcare system is broken. That's a little bit more specific. Do you feel like our education system is broken? Even there, you're putting the thought into somebody's head. You're assuming that there is a feeling out there. So the whole question and the way the questions are posed, let's face it, they dictate some of the answer. Having said all of that, again, I'm not sure that you can ignore there's a certain level of anger. I mean, we just talked about the anniversary of the truck convoy. Say what you will about the craziness and the conspiracy theories and all of the bullshit that went with that. There is a level of dissatisfaction, disenfranchisement, whatever you want to call it, where we feel like there is a problem in this country. I'm talking about it. I'm worrying about it. I'm trying to make ends meet, having to spend, you know, way more on housing, way more on food than I was even during the pandemic. We've seen these numbers go up, and the only thing we know for sure is that it's not going to turn around anytime soon. Am I pissed off, angry? Is there a malaise there? Yep. And we got to get at it. To put it on a bumper sticker kind of approach to it and make it a political issue, it's not going to solve anything, right? Because the next government is not going to be the one that's going to solve it. So there's the real question. At the heart of this poll, how is it that we turn that mood around in this country? Some interesting fallout after the murder of Tyre Nichols. Of course, everybody focusing on what the Memphis police did. And we talked at length last week to Courtney Betty, in case you missed that. You should go back and have a listen to it. Courtney is a local lawyer here in the city of Toronto and had an interesting perspective on it, just in as much as he's dealt with a lot of youth organizations in this city, particularly young black kids and their relationship with police and law enforcement and so on. So it was a pretty interesting perspective we got from him in terms of what the Tyre Nichols story will mean long term. There is all kinds of hope that it's going to change policing and policing culture in the United States, perhaps here in Canada to some degree. And Courtney, not all that thoughtful or optimistic, I'll say. He's always thoughtful. So that was one thing. But here was what I found really interesting, and I'm going to put this in the show notes. It's from Stat News, and the story is not necessarily focused on the police necessarily. They're focusing on the EMS workers who showed up at the scene. And I'm just going to read you the top paragraph here from Christine Kao at Stat News. By the time medics arrived, Tyre Nichols was sitting on the ground, handcuffed and propped up against a police car. The 29-year-old's face was bloody. He was groaning in pain. On January 7th, after pulling Nichols over for a traffic stop, Memphis police had tased, pepper sprayed, punched him, kicked him in the head, beaten him with a baton. He weighed about 150 pounds, according to his mom, and he suffered from Crohn's disease. Other than helping Nichols back up when he slumped over, the emergency medical technicians who'd arrived on the scene barely engaged with him, according to police body cam footage of the incident. As they stood nearby, Nichols collapsed onto the asphalt and writhed alone for minutes at a time. National and state emergency medical services guidelines call for medics at a bare minimum to immediately check their patient's airway, breathing, and vital signs. For head trauma, they would also immobilize the spine and neck, give oxygen to prevent brain damage. None of that happened for Nichols. They didn't do bread and butter EMS, says Amiri Hamed, an emergency medical physician at the University of Chicago. They didn't do step one, which is assess your patient. This story is far from over, whether it's not going to change anything in terms of EMS workers, frontline, don't know. But boy, that's almost as bad. I mean, they didn't inflict the beating, but they didn't assess them when they arrived. Wonder if that's going to come up in the State of the Union. Yes, the State of the Union will happen tomorrow night in Washington. President Joe Biden will give his address in the evening. And, you know, against the backdrop of everything that's going on internationally, got the news this morning of the earthquake in Turkey and Syria, and the number of people killed there, of course. Everything that's going on in Ukraine, that will be front and center. There's no question that the Tyre Nichols story will come up. The shootings, the mass shootings across the United States. And I just think the whole thing against the backdrop of what happened on the weekend, that the prelude to the State of the Union was hyperventilation over a hot air balloon. I mean, what kind of metaphor was that? Right? They're all wound up about a Chinese spy balloon. Ignoring the fact that these balloons had floated over the US, continental U.S. before, one. Two, there are satellites that everybody acknowledges are up there that the Chinese and others are using to track what is going on and keep an eye on what's going on in the United States. Hot air about hot air. All right. So the question is now, how old is old? How old is old? You know, when I was a kid, I've got, you know, pictures of grandparents and great-grandparents, etc. And I look at them and they look old to me because they always looked old to me. But then I realized, holy cow, they were only in their 50s when that picture was taken. And that looks like somebody who might be closer to 80 these days. I've got a picture of Jack Dennett in my studio. Jack was the number one news anchor on CFRB. He did the 8 o'clock news. That was a big deal. 8 a.m. Fire off the Hunter horn and Jack would come on the air. And I have this LP, a record, a vinyl record, recordings of some of his newscasts and broadcasts. And the album cover is just a picture of Jack. And it astounds me that the photo of him, now this is before he died, of course. The postmortem picture wouldn't have been so good. He looked like a guy in his 70s. He didn't live to 70. And the photograph was sometime in his 50s. So our whole idea of aging, our idea of, you know, how old is old. Right now, if you look at it, there are more and more people living to the age of 100. My grandfather lived to the age of 102. Right? Next week, we're going to have a funeral for Hazel McCallion. Lived to 102. That's still remarkable, but less so these days. More and more. So we're going to get to this point where all of a sudden, what are we going to do when we have this aging and relatively healthy demographic? This population is growing. That age group is growing because we're living longer. We have generally a more healthy lifestyle, and we have improved medicine and technology to help us get there. That's the question. Lisa Taylor at Challenge Factory joins us, and she says, we have 8 years to rethink how old is old. I know people are talking about this sort of tsunami in terms of the demographics that we're facing, and I just don't think we have a grasp on this in terms of the intermediate effect that an aging population is going to have on things we take for granted, whether that's healthcare to begin with, or just, you know, how we're going to staff the healthcare services, whatever it might be. Lisa, this is one of these things, and you sort of equated it in your article to the urgency around Y2K, that we had a deadline and we met it and we solved the problem. Whether there was a problem there or not, we solved a problem. This is even more concrete, I think, than the Y2K concern.
Yeah, and I want to say right off the top, just, you know, your use of the word tsunami is an interesting framing to begin with, to cast aging as a natural disaster as opposed to a naturally occurring event. And just even the mindset that that puts us in, you know, the paralysis of, oh my gosh, there's a tsunami, we can't do anything but just wait to see, does it hit? And if it hits, then it's all hands on deck. And I think that that contributes to this Y2K mentality a little bit, where we can either wait and see what's going to happen, which we've been doing for decades. I mean, talking about aging and the aging demographic and population change is not a new topic. Challenge Factory's existed for more than 10 years. David Foote wrote a seminal book, you know, Boom, Bust, and Echo, decades ago, that predicted exactly what we're seeing now, because everyone ages exactly on time. It's entirely predictable of what's going to come next. And so there's no need to really wait for this tsunami to hit, which I actually think is poor framing. I think that instead what we should look at is we're living longer and we're getting older. And as we live longer and stay active older, the systems that are set up that presume that things are going to happen at a certain age are breaking. Because it's not really the magic of the number. It's the magic of, you know, the milestone that you hit where you all of a sudden need healthcare. And that's not tied to a number. That's tied to health. And so I think the complexity of what we're dealing with is, first of all, recognizing aging is not necessarily a problem. In fact, in a lot of cases, it's part of the solution for how we get out of some of the really messy situations that we're in certain circumstances around jobs, around healthcare. But only if we look at these things as not problematic, but instead as just a natural course of how we're advancing in our cities and in our societies.
It is quite literally, though, just comes down to cultural perceptions on so many levels, right? And we have ingrained in our conversation, in our vernacular, that 65 is the age of retirement. Right. I know lots of folks, and I know you know as many more or more, who work well past 65,
100%.
Are entirely productive and engaged and passionate about what they do. And it's not because they have to work. We're healthier, to your point. And I think we are more engaged socially than we would have been perhaps even 15, 20 years ago. So that changes that calculus around whether we're talking about healthcare or the workplace.
I love that. And I think that that also brings us back to what we can learn from this Y2K kind of approach and moment, because 2030 is the moment in time when the entire baby boomer cohort crosses over so that everyone is 65 plus, right? There aren't any younger boomers that are still within the quote unquote working age category. And then we have to figure out, well, okay, so if that entire population is now no longer in the quote unquote working age demographic, but a vast majority of them are still working, well, what do we do? And it really gives us an opportunity now that we've had for a long time, but now really we can put some focus and energy on it and say, like, we can see that horizon. 2030 is not that far away, and figure out, if people are going to be naturally working in larger numbers in different ways for all different purposes, as you say, some because they want to, some because they have to, some because it's good for their mental health, it's good for avoiding social isolation. There's so many different reasons why people are going to continue to remain engaged and productive and using the knowledge and wisdom that they've amassed over their lifetime so far. If people are going to do that, well, let's not wait for 2030 when the last person crosses over. That December 31 baby, I want to know who that is. That when that last person crosses over the threshold, let's start thinking now and rethink from the top down all of our systems and structures that says, okay, what if it's just completely natural? What if we presume that everyone is going to remain engaged in their communities in some way? Paid work, volunteer work. They're not going to shuffle off somewhere and just play golf for 30 years. 65 is no longer that finish line. How would we recast the story that we tell about our 60s, 70s, and 80s? And then let's make that story true now. Let's not wait.
I think of my dad when we get into these conversations. He started his career in forestry at the age of 17, and 37 years later, he retired at the ripe old age of 54. And not because he was, well, quite frankly, he could, and based on the nature, but he was ready to retire. Having said that, to your point, he didn't kind of sit around and just wait for things to come to him. He was probably busier than ever in doing things that were productive in his community or for the just at home around the house. So even how we quantify and put value on our activities outside of our, you know, career parameters, I think we have to recalibrate that as well, don't we?
Yeah, and I mean, the true definition of career would include all of that. So career is the intersection of work, life, learning, and identity. So most people, when you say career, they think of their job. But really, countries that do this well and organizations and people and systems and structures that recognize the real value of career development will recognize that career is actually not, it's not just about a job. And it's certainly not just about matching a person to a job, but it's about looking at who is that person, who are they in the context of the community that they live within and the labor market that they live within, and then what's the best application of their skills and interests across paid work, volunteer work, learning, continuing to learn. There's new benefits that are coming in that are being introduced or have been introduced recently that give us opportunities to amass credits to be able to apply for learning when we're in our 40s and 50s. Pretty interesting, right? That we're starting to see some of the structural shifts that says, you know what, this old paradigm of you go to school, you learn everything you need to know for the rest of your life, and then you go out and you work and you earn every money, all the money that you need for the rest of your life, and then you retire and do nothing, is very outdated. It's a social contract that's broken. We don't actually live our lives that way anymore. So we need to be learning all the way through our lives. We need to be volunteering and working in our communities all the way through our lives. We need to be working all the way through our lives. And we need to find that right balance for each individual. And that's actually the role of career development. That's the job career developers do across the country.
Well, but the other side of that is supporting that cohort, because and we talk about healthcare, which is sort of the obvious one, because as we get older, we're probably going to need, you know, healthcare intervening in our lives more than ever. But you know, I'm at an age where I could already take the Canada Pension Plan. I haven't, because I don't really need it at this point. But the point being that even there, you begin to look at that lens, and I'm thinking, and I don't know, I'm not the actuarial in here, but that seems to me like an inefficient or a wasteful use of the money. If I don't need it and I'm still taking it, how does that, what kind of pressure down the road does that put on supporting somebody who gets into their 80s or 90s? Or, you know, we're going to see a lot of people live to 100 in our lifetime.
Right. It's, you know, it's more and more being seen as common that if you, you know, if you live to 75, children that are born today and my kids that are in their 20s, if they live to 75, it's likely that they're going to live past 100. That's what the predictions are saying. So to your point, yeah, we need to figure this out. And pensions and retirement schemes and all the supports that are there were put in under certain rules and certain calculations. But the calculations have changed, and it is very complicated to be able to update that. And I do want to mention the complication is in a couple of different ways. I mean, the first is just the financial instrumentation and figuring out, well, okay, so are we going to do what other countries do, which ties the age of retirement and the eligibility of benefits to life expectancy? So it actually floats. And instead of it being a fixed age, it's, you know, life expectancy minus so many years, so that as life expectancy grows, the eligibility grows. And while you can't predict that it's going to happen to you at 72 necessarily, you as a citizen have a good understanding of what's happening and an ability to plan for your life because it becomes just the norm. So I think there's all kinds of ways that we can take a look at revamping the systems and structures that indicate to us it's now time to retire or that support us. I think it's important that we remember that some of those structures exist to support the most vulnerable that aren't necessarily the Dave Traffords or the Lisa Taylors as we get older, but people that, you know, need to have continued support. And there's good evidence that that actually is done fairly well. I think the other piece that's just as complicated as getting the financial instrumentation and all of the actuarial tables and everything else calculated and updated is just the mindset change. I know I've been, you know, talking on this topic now for more than 10 years, and there is almost always someone who says, you know what, Lisa, like, that's really nice that you're talking about working longer, but I've had my eye on the prize at 65 for a really long time, and I am not interested in working any longer. And if you're trying to get us to stay in the workforce longer, no, thank you, because that is my finish line. And I think especially as we go through this generational change, right? We've added 20 years of productivity in a single generation. And that means that the rules that existed when everybody who's currently a boomer started working has shifted while you've been working. And I think that we also need to honor to say, there's going to be people that are going to say, this is great for the future, but for me, I want my prize at that finish line. That's what I've been working towards. And be able to find a way to honor that for them while also recognizing it is lonely and isolating out the other side. That 65-year-old who is so bent on making sure that they're no longer working past 60 or 65 may find by 72 or 73, they're pretty bored. And they've lost the ability to really be able to explain who they are, to introduce themselves in present tense or in future tense instead of saying, well, I used to be. And so, you know, I think we need to watch that balance of how does it feel to be the individuals that are navigating through this while we also at the systems level say what's broken and what needs to be recast for future generations.
Yeah, and it's no small task because to your point around, you know, there are those who are going to want to say 65 is my date, which was pretty much an arbitrary date. I mean, it does go back to life expectancy, I guess, when they first initiated it. But, you know, again, I go back to my dad. He was retired for as long as he worked. He literally 37 years working, 37 years retired before he passed away. So, and he, you know, I wouldn't say he never wanted for anything. He had good support. He had a good pension and so on. So there is an example of where somebody can actually have that eye on the prize and do it well. And before they're 65, even, but that sort of breaks with the norm in as much as we look at it almost as a personal responsibility. If I'm going to retire early, it's up to me to make sure that I've invested well and taken care of my money. And I would agree with that. On the other hand, we have this other conversation, back to your point about those who are, you know, the vulnerable among us. This conversation around a guaranteed income begins to have to be part of this conversation. And there has to be that scale so that it's not just about CPP. It's about a constant acknowledgement that I need a basic income to make sure that I am healthy and I'm productive and I can keep doing these things in my community and I have stable housing into my 90s and, you know, where I don't need assisted living. That starts to weave its way into it.
It does. And in fact, I mean, one of the things that is true is we see poverty levels among the most vulnerable drop as they age into the old age system, because the old age system is actually set up to be structured and to be supportive in ways that are a little bit more generous than basic social supports. So, you know, there's lots of discussion, and I know that you're leading lots of conversations in your 2030 podcast project with Dan Hetherington as well, that, you know, we're looking at the origins of poverty, and poverty when that old age system kicks in is better supported than through our early careers and mid-careers or early life and midlife. So there's some indications there of ways that we can be looking for some solutions. But I think that really what we need to be thinking about here is supports over the course of our entire life course. And one of the things that's true in Canada about getting supports in general related to work is we have a fail-first model. So in Canada, you can get access to supports, whether that's supports from professionals that can help and intervene with employment services and help with finding jobs and navigation, or whether that's financial supports, when something goes wrong, when you lose a job, when you become injured, when something happens, but something has to happen to you where you have to fall off the intended course and you have to almost fail first before you get access to these services. And then we end up with this Robin Hood mentality where we take, you know, resources, whether it's taxation resources, but we take resources from those that have and we kind of spread them to those that don't in a way to try to equalize society to make things better for everyone. And an economist that comes out of the London School of Economics has, you know, been writing frequently recently to talk about the fact that the really most active Western civilizations that are doing the best at staying ahead of these things have realized that these services and these provisions are not about Robin Hood. It's not about spreading from the haves to the have-nots within our society. It's a piggy bank. And the investments that we make in individuals is actually something that we're amassing so that, for example, investing in people so that early in their careers, those that are slipping through the cracks can find jobs, means that when my children need teachers, when I need healthcare assistance, when there's something that I need later in my own life, there's people that are working in those places because they've been supported. And so it's not really a redistribution of wealth that we need to look at as we're looking at solving some of the issues related to poverty. It's recognizing investing in people and in reducing poverty actually makes me better, because then the things that I need are better supported because we've put the people into the right places in order to be doing those kinds of things. So that shift from, you know, how can we stop being Robin Hoods or thinking of these services as Robin Hoods, which is a really traditional way of thinking about it. You hear people talk about it that way all the time. And instead, how can it be a piggy bank that makes sure that we're investing in everybody over the course of our lifespan so that when we are older and need care, there's care workers there? That takes a different type of mindset and shift, and it includes thinking about everybody in the picture and not just those that need service right now or those that need employment and income support right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the point of intersection, there's not a lot of space, but it doesn't take long for that space to grow as we move down the road, right? But just that it's a very slight shift in the focus that you're talking about is rather nuanced, in fact. But it really, it comes down to that question of priority, but understanding it in a much broader peripheral view, rather than, again, I come back to the emphasis on it's up to Lisa to make sure that you've got the right resources in your RSP plan to make sure that, you know, you're well taken care of in your elder years. And again, there's nothing wrong with that, but society can, I think we bristle at the idea because, as you will have heard, well, how can we afford to pay for that is really the default here. And I my question back to you is, how can we afford not to?
Right. And that really comes back to that piggy bank analogy, right? That it's not a matter of, you know, spending the money and therefore having to make trade-offs. It's actually figuring out where those bets are for the investment, making the problem bigger so that we can have more trade-offs, right? So, you know, the example that's given in often in these kinds of discussions is someone who's 58 or 59 and was intending to retire may work longer if they recognize that that will help to contribute to better education for their children. And if better education for their children actually then through increased income and taxation and all of the other things that increased productivity brings into society, people work longer, that increases the quality of education for their children, well, then the next generation is going to be better served to be able to help as that same person goes from being 58 to 68 to 78. Now the caregivers that are helping them, the medical doctors, everybody that's helping them in their 80s, is because of that investment that was made in their children when they were in their 50s. So it's an intergenerational transfer, not just of wealth and opportunity and investment, but to also just think about these things as a bigger problem than just individuals with their finances or individuals with their jobs. It's really looking at the whole system. And sometimes these trade-offs get easier when we make problems bigger rather than trying to make them smaller.
Before we go, I just want to touch on this idea in terms of the effect. We've talked a lot about supporting our society as we get older and an aging population, but at the same time, you know, people who are remaining in the workplace. I just had a conversation with a class at Fanshawe College in London, and spoke to a bunch of journalism students, their first year journalism students. And I give them full marks for being brave enough to get involved and enroll in a journalism program in this day and age. And, you know, I suggested to them that the headlines are screaming, that media is circling the bowl, that it's not the place to be, and so on. But I would differ in that respect, in as much as I'm not sure specifically that we can look at an old model. Some of the legacy media might not be the best place to be, you know, counting on your journalism career. But the work that you do, the skills that you are developing, don't take them for granted, because they do have value. And that what you are, in fact, learning and developing here is something that is going to be good for you and good for the rest of us. And so when I posted just that I had been at Fanshawe on social media, a colleague of mine said, "Oh, sure, I can just see this is a back in the day conversation with Dave." And I said, "No, it wasn't really. It was the days to come. It really needs to be this conversation." And so even in an industry that appears to be in jeopardy, I think this is a really good example of where we're seeing new business models. We're seeing new opportunities to create new media. I mean, we're doing it right here. And the idea that there is a market for it, there is a place that for it in terms of service to the community and the larger society, we need to start looking at that, and less in terms of, I'm the guy at the end of my career, and these are the 20-year-olds who are just beginning. We're in this environment, we're all pretty much on the same plane in terms of where we want to go if we're going to work. So in the old days, you know, I would have been bounced out of the environment because I'm the old guy. Now I'm learning from those 20-year-olds. My experience comes to bear in terms of what they can count on. And I think it's a completely different kind of ecosystem when we look at that. And again, I'm not looking for a job, but the point being, I think we're too easy to fall back on that old stereotype that the 65-year-old is no longer useful in the workplace. I'd rather have the cheaper, more energetic 22-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in what you just outlined that it really just emphasizes the shift in our own mindset that we need to think about the intersection of age and learning. You know, part of the reason why I'm going to use the term intergenerational workplaces are so much more powerful than traditional organizations that see age or time, years of service, as a marker of anything, and a way to kind of structure, you know, let's have a program for the younger employees, and then let's have an older worker program. You know, that way of separating the generations really removes the power and removes the energy and the innovation possibility that exists when we actually recognize that we're in an intergenerational workforce. And that doesn't just mean that it's, you know, divided by generations. Everyone knows there's lots of people of lots of ages working together and at work today. But what the intergenerational component brings into the discussion is that the world is changing so fast that we are all learning about the world around us all at the same time. Younger employees are coming in with what they've experienced through their education and the way that they've experienced life to date. And they're bringing new energy and new questions just the same way I did when I first entered the workplace. That's not something that's new. But older workers are learning about the new world of work alongside the younger workers, but with all of the wisdom and experience that comes with it. So they recognize where there are massive shifts, like what you're describing in the media industry, where the model is broken or changing, it's in flux, it's a little uncertain what's going to happen next. I come out of the tech sector, and I started my career just before the internet became a tool that was used for business. there were some pretty broken business models and years of uncertainty and not sure what's going to happen and companies that completely disappeared. We've been through this before, and those of us that have been through it before or have seen it before bring that wisdom to the situation. And the younger generation brings the enthusiasm and experience that they have through their education and questions, why do we do things this way? And it's only when we work together that actually we get that breakthrough of what the new is going to be. So it's that intergenerational model that actually has the power for being able to get out ahead of solving the problems and to come back full circle to make sure that we don't just keep doing things the way that we've been doing until a Y2K comes and cuts us off and forces us to change, but instead says, you know what? Okay, we see this on the horizon. We know this is the way this is going. Now, if we could shape the way that we wanted this industry, this sector, this company, this community, this city, if we could shape that so that we avoid the tsunami, we avoid the Y2K, what would we do differently? And then how do we start doing that right now? That's an intergenerational conversation. And that's how we get to piggy bank thinking and being able to make sure that we actually have systems, structures, from education through to pensions, that acknowledges the fact that we're living and working longer.
I don't want to end on a pessimistic note here, because what you're describing is necessary, but we don't have the urgency around this, as I said. But where we did see urgency and effective change and new ways and new models and pivoting was during the pandemic. And that was sort of one of these things where we should have seen it coming as well, but we didn't. But learning from that experience, doesn't that or shouldn't that inform what we're doing over the next 8 to 10 years as far as this subject is concerned?
Yeah, I think that the pandemic showed us that when we really need to and want to, and when it impacts individuals personally, we actually can move mountains pretty quickly and we can do some pretty amazing things. Not wanting to leave this on a pessimistic note says, I'm not sure how much of that has actually stuck with us as we're now coming out the other side. I mean, less than I think we anticipated, where we really felt that that was going to be a moment there, everything shifted and stayed permanently looking for solutions in different ways. What I do think is really important when it comes to thinking about aging and the effect that aging has on us at all ages and stages for everyone, not just for the older population, but for everyone in society, is this is an entirely predictable thing that's happening to us. And if we are not able to get ourselves into good shape to do right by the oldest among us, and then have this be something that actually cascades through all of the generations with a healthy approach to what does it mean to be any age within our society, if we're not able to address this when it is entirely predictable, I can tell you exactly how many Canadians fall into the older Canadian bucket any year that you want me to, because people age exactly on time, then how are we going to continue to address the things that aren't predictable? This is the very best playground and sandbox for us to actually take everybody in all of the different categories of society and work together to figure out how to solve this problem, because we can define it. We can put a box around it. We know when exactly it's going to happen. We know what demand is going to look like. We know what the supply is going to be required. We can predict so much of this that it's actually a really good test ground for, and what happens next when we need to deal with disruption that we can't predict. And that's the Y2K factor that I keep coming back to say, you know what, Y2K was another example where there was something, it was entirely predictable. From within the tech sector, I can tell you there was an enormous problem, and we were able to mitigate it to the point that those that weren't in the sector would say, no problem at all. But something shifted forever that day, and that was our attitude towards technology. From that point forward, everyone knew technology had a role to play in their life personally, because they had had that personal experience of 1999 wondering, is the microwave going to work January 1st, 2000? That personal experience meant that even if I wasn't a techie, it mattered to me. We need to take that same approach to aging, because everyone is aging, everyone. Not just older people. When we talk about aging, we tend to talk about the aged. everyone is aging. So how can we get out ahead of it so that aging becomes a non-event? And everyone personally just ages into their next decade and their next century.
Lisa Taylor, thanks for joining us. It's always good to get your brain on these subjects. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Yes, thank you to Lisa Taylor, president at Challenge Factory. And you should check out some of the work that they are doing. We did a podcast series with them. It's called Hidden Talent. And if you're an employer and you're looking to recruit new folks, I mean, the age thing is one thing. We focus specifically on hidden talent, like hiding in plain view, literally, where military folks are transitioning from the military into a civilian career. And on the one hand, you can help them do that. But on the other hand, there are employers who have a blind spot and they don't really fully appreciate what it is a military vet can bring to the operation and all kinds of skills that they develop over the course of their career in the military beyond, you know, some of them are soft skills, but there's just a highly technical, logistic, you know, that kind of area of expertise that they can bring to your project or your team or your job, your business, that is. But we don't see it that way. And the reason is because we have a blind spot. We don't ask the right questions. So if you're in the market for new people, check it out. It's called Hidden Talent. And you will find it, well, probably pretty much where you are listening to this podcast today. Okay, that'll do it for me. It is February the 6th. It's a Monday. We're kicking off another week. Tomorrow, we're going to talk a little bit more about this whole AI conversation. Yesterday, last week, we kicked it off and we talked about the app that can, you know, write the MBA exam and pass it at university. It can write poetry and all that sort of thing. There's some AI learning that's going on right now. And it's really interesting to see how that AI learning is being used to get at how we function in society, how we deal with the Internet of Things, how we deal with the algorithms that seem to drive our lives. Yeah, so AI against AI. We're going to talk about that. That's tomorrow here on Now and Next. Our friend Ujjwal Arkalgood is a cultural anthropologist, and he's got a thing or two to say about a thing or two when it comes to that kind of stuff. All right, join me on the social media. Again, you can find me at Dave Trafford on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Now and Next is produced by Becky Coles. Our production manager is Jamie Nickerson. Audio editors are Mike Trutler and Drew Garner. And our sonic logo designer is Greg McDonald. Our executive producers are Dave and Aaron Trafford.
This is SSN.
Story Studio Network.